Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 27 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet Jane Draycott speaks with Julia Coppice about her modern translation of Pearl, the great medieval poem of earthly loss and spiritual consolation.
The medieval dream vision, Pearl, is a 1,200-line elegy in verse. It's narrated by a bereaved father who falls asleep in the garden where his infant daughter has died, and in his dream he calls across a river to his daughter's spirit. The poem is in fact part of the same manuscript as the more famous Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and it's been described by Boyd Tonkin as a wrenchingly beautiful vision of love and bereavement and the consolation of faith. The poet Jane Draycott recently took on the task of translating the piece into modern English. Hailed by fellow poet and medieval scholar Bernard O'Donoghue as an event of great significance and excitement, Jane Draycott's Pearl was a Poetry Book Society recommended translation, as well as winner of a Times Stephen Spender Prize for translation. Jane talked to me about what enticed her to take on the project in the first place, and how exactly she set about it. I'd like to start by asking you, Jane, why you think the Pearl poem, which has been around for over 600 years now, has so rarely been translated?
Well, it's a very good question. Although the manuscript is 600 years old, it was sort of in a dark cupboard for many of those centuries. So it was in the Cotton collection, but only, re-illuminated actually in the middle of the 19th century. But the manuscript, which also contains the better known Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, began to get more attention from translators around the turn of the century. And Gawain has had a lot of the attention, so that's a fantastic story. It's assumed that the same poet wrote both poems. If so, they were extremely kind of talented in terms of their range, let alone anything else. But I think Pearl is an elegy. It's an elegy for an infant daughter. It just doesn't have the same... It doesn't make the same noise in terms of its content, but in terms of the task of translation, it's a little bit more difficult because it's so very strongly patterned in terms of its rhyme. So it's quite a challenge for translators to take on these 12-line stanzas, which operate with only two rhymes across the 12 lines.
So what was the appeal for you then in tackling this, what sounds like rather an ambitious project? What was it that set the whole thing in motion for you?
Well, like a lot of students who studied English literature at university, I was introduced to it then. That was my first encounter with it. And I was very taken with it then. I'm not quite sure why I was. A lot of people didn't like it because it's very tight in terms of its action. It's very sort of complete and tightly bound in the way, for instance, that Gawain or Chaucer isn't. They're much more kind of active and action poems. So this is much more of a meditation. Looking back, I wonder whether the father-daughter relationship at the heart of the poem might have been what had got to me. My own father had died not too many years before, a couple of years before I went up to university. I certainly wasn't conscious of this at the time. But looking back, I think that may have had something to do with it. And I was just very, very struck with it then. And one of the things we had to do for homework, as it were make a translation of it. A translation which I actually had on my kitchen table when I was doing this last translation, amongst others. And then years and years later, when our own daughters were preparing to leave home, for no reason I can account for, I began to look at it again. I just began to look at it again. I have no idea why. It came to my mind after over 30 years.
And
I got out my translation.
What it was that triggered that?
I don't know what it was that triggered it, but I looked at it again and I wrote a long 100-line poem of my own, which sort of floated on the lexical patterning, the patterning of words, repeating words and images in that original 14th century poem. And then I was into it. And then Bernard O'Donoghue, in fact, was talking to me about what I'd done and suggested I might have a go at translating. It hadn't occurred to me to even attempt that.
Okay, so I was going to say you're an established and well-loved poet in your own right with several wonderful collections to your name. So I wonder how translating a piece like this compares with the process of composing an original poem.
It's very interesting. This was the first piece of translation I had done, and the most difficult part of the process was beginning, was starting in on it. And that felt very like starting on a new poem of your own, in the sense that you wait, or this is what I've tended to do, wait for the sort of right acoustic, the right phrasing, the right mood. It's not exactly like novelists wait for the voice. It isn't exactly that, but it's something close to it, in order to be able to take the first step on the path, because there's something in the way I've always worked whereby if I set off on the wrong path in those terms, I can't start again.
You sort of wrong foot yourself. Yes. And there's no going back after that.
Yes. Yeah. And so in that sense, I simply waited until the first lines of the translation came to me. And so that did seem, at that point, very like starting on a poem of my own.
So did you, in a way, have to find a voice? You talked about novelist voice, but did you have to find the right voice to speak the father's voice in the poem through, if you like?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. The other thing that's been interesting for me, that was interesting for me taking it on, I'd never written a sustained narrative poem myself. So that's one of the things I sort of climbed inside, because translation is very like putting someone else's clothes on, putting someone else's gloves on. So climbing inside the sort of dynamic, the drama, really, how do you sustain a narrative over that length of time? And I had to find the poet in me who could do that.
That's really interesting. So did it literally feel like a kind of, you know, getting dressed as this other person each time you sat down to write and then taking off those robes at the end of each session?
It began to feel like that. At first, I thought that was what I was going to have to do. I thought I have to work out the sort of personality of the narration and somehow relay that in my own, the rhythms that are in my head, in contemporary English, my contemporary phrasing. That's how I thought I would sustain the thing. But actually, of course, it's a sustained poem, which means it's a sustained job for the translator. So it took 18 months or so. And in the end, I decided not to work on it consecutively. I didn't work in a linear way on it. I worked on scenes so that I could find the energy of each scene. This may be a little bit more, I think, possibly the way novelists work. So I worked on scenes because each scene has its own energy and its own atmosphere, its own sort of lighting on stage, so to speak. So in the end, I did actually leave the Pearl Poet in a room beside me. That seemed to be a necessary thing to do. And then finally, I put the whole thing together and realised that it didn't sound like a relay of the Pearl Poet, and it didn't really sound like a very coherent piece in its own right in my modern translation. And so then I took many, many, many sweeps at it at quite a detailed level.
I wonder if you could just outline for us, just very briefly, the general shape of the poem in terms of content.
We start with the mourning father speaking as a jeweller who has lost their precious pearl. The mourning father has lost his infant daughter and seems to be in a scene which is a little like a graveyard, a beautiful garden where she lies. And mourning her, he falls asleep on the place where she lies and has a dream. And in the dream, he sees another much, much more jewelled landscape. Hills, rivers, valleys, trees, meadows, beautiful golden streams running down hillsides. And in cutting through this beautiful, very mysterious, shining, bejewelled landscape is a river studded with gems, blindingly light. and across the other side of the river at this moment, which I think is very dreamlike, as if from nowhere and yet as if she's always been there, stands a child. And the child speaks to him and, again, in a very dreamlike way, is transformed as he looks at her into a beautiful young maiden, as a beautiful young maiden in a beautiful white dress studded with pearls. And she explains to him that there's no need to mourn. I'm here, I'm happy, I'm a bride of Christ, 144,000 of us. And he says, you can't possibly be married, you're only two. He doesn't believe it. He can't take that Christian consolation. But finally, she shows him a vision of the heavenly kingdom, the jeweled city. A lot of this comes from the Apocalypse. A lot of that material comes from the Apocalypse and from the New Testament. And finally, he loses sight of her, very like Dante, suddenly seeing Beatrice, and then she's gone. And it ends with a short section where he appears to accept the consolation offered, the Christian consolation offered by the Pearl Maiden. But the grieving goes on right through to the very end of the poem.
It seems to me that you've succeeded brilliantly in modernising the poem while at the same time staying faithful to the original on a whole variety of levels. For instance, your version, like the original, was written in tetrameter all the way through, those lovely strong four-beat lines. But how keen were you that your translation should work independently of the original?
I think it was very important that it could stand free, that it could work in its own right as a poem that communicated something. The content isn't mine. The imaginative world, all the imaginative work comes from the Pearl Poet. But it's very important, it was important, yes, that it would be readable. It would be counterproductive, really, otherwise.
Can you say a little bit more about the technical challenges? I mean, there's a lot of alliteration, isn't there, in the original? But as I understand it, that's not the half of it. How strict were you about reproducing the alliterative sound of the poem and other technical features?
The alliterative phrasing is one of the absolute joys of the writing of the Pearl Poet, the Garwayne poet. It's not just the music on the ear. It gives a tremendous narrative energy. Every alliterative phrase somehow or other picks up on some dynamo or other and drives it forward to the next alliterative line. I suppose that's a lot of the power of that it's drawing on the Anglo-Saxon tradition. That I allowed to surface as much as I could kind of engender it in my ear. But it isn't as audible, possibly, in my translation as in the original. The original is quite heavily stitched, if I can put it that way, in metrical terms and harmonic terms. So quite strongly accented across the four beats of every line. Many of the lines are end-stopped and all of the lines rhyme perfectly. So there's a sort of strong stitching going on at the end of every line. So I tried to work free of that end stitching, working much more with run-on lines. I mean, I've described it as before as trying to just loosen the stitching on it.
Was that to do with an attempt to modernise the poem and make it less obviously stitched?
Yes, I think there's something about the modern ear which appreciates that. I'm not sure I can trace it accurately myself. I probably don't know enough about it. This is one aspect of the translation that I think I was waiting for when I waited. I drank quite a lot of red wine whilst I was waiting night after night to know how this was going to work in my ear.
Hmm.
And that's one of the things that happened. And then when I had the first four lines, the first four lines came to me as a set one evening. And then I thought, that's it. I can hear it now.
But listening to you, it sounds as if you must have had a very strong impulse to do this project. If you invested that time in waiting for it to come right, you must have had a feeling that it was going to come right at some point.
Yes, and also, well, a hope that it was going to come right. Also, a fantastic sense of responsibility. It's such an important poem. It's an absolutely beautiful poem. Mm. I mean, it's been described as possibly the most intricately decorated poem in Middle English. It's definitely one of the most important elegies in a long tradition of elegies for infant children that exist.
But in spite of the poem's technical brilliance and also the moral conclusion that it reaches, that God is never wrong to act as he does, even if it means taking away our loved ones. For me, the poem's power lies in the fact that this is also an intensely personal poem. At its heart is the voice, as you say, of a father grieving for his little girl.
Yes, and I think that is very much part of its power for a contemporary audience. It's interesting that in the British Museum display case, the manuscript's label describes it as an account of a father's grief for a lost daughter and makes no mention of it as a piece of Christian consolation. So it makes no mention of that at all. And I think that's not just because contemporary audiences are perhaps less necessarily likely to be Christian readers or readers with Christian faith. I think that's because within the poem, the power lies not in the traditional material in which the account of the grief is couched, but it's actually in the electric charge of that account of grief, confusion, a sense of resentment. Mm. So we recognise the psychology of grief, and anybody who had read this over the intervening centuries would recognise the psychology of grief, because that is what the poet's interested in. I mean, the poet hadn't necessarily himself, it probably was a him, hadn't necessarily experienced that himself. It could have been a commission, although it seems so strongly charged that I imagine it is a personal account of that very precious experience of loss. This is also about the action of elegy, which is so close a manifestation of the psychology of bereavement. The sense that the grieving itself is precious.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poem, which has all the sort of technical aspects of a perfected pearl, it's circular, it is perfected and finished and echoing and unified in many technical ways, as well as in terms of its imaginative world.
What you say about it having the unity of a pearl, that's certainly true, isn't it? But it doesn't necessarily have the completion. I think it's the fact that the father doesn't quite manage to be consoled. The fact that in spite of everything, he goes to swim across the river to get to his daughter towards the end of the poem. And it occurs to me that there's an irony in the fact that what is most personal is often at the same time most universal. So for me, the subject matter of Pearl gets right to the heart of what it means to be human. Is that its main appeal, or one of its main appeals for you too?
It is. It is certainly. The other power that it releases, or that it holds, is the power of the Pearl poets, the Garwin poets' fantastic imaginative world. Mm. The Pearl poet sees the vision, but what he sees is not another world. So when he sees the river in this jewelled landscape, what he sees is a river from this world, from his world, from our world. So everything he sees which relates to the other world, across the river, that is, after death, he describes in terms of life. When the Pearl Maiden is saying to him, "You don't need to worry, I may have died, but I'm living here now as a bride of Christ in this eternal jewelled state of perfection. Only death can bring a person here. There's nothing to fear." His response is, "I don't want death, I want life." And buried in that is, "I don't want you dead, I want you alive." There's a tremendous moment where he sees her first as a child across the river and recognises her. And within one phrase, she's become a grown woman. As I say, so much of this seems to have the character of real dreams, dreams that follow bereavement especially. So simultaneously, she is a child and quite logically at the same time, the young, beautiful woman that I suppose she would have become had she lived.
Yes, because that's quite a surprising moment, isn't it, for the reader? You do a double take at first when you read that bit and think, well, you know, she's 2 years old, how can she be a beautiful maiden at the same time? But as you say, it has an emotional veracity to it somehow. I'm not quite sure how that's been pulled off.
Well, I think partly because the poem is operating on the edges of allegory, but also that is what the poetic mind does. That is metaphor. It is perfectly possible, you know, even beyond the allegorical system of symbols, even beyond that, it's quite possible for us to understand in any poem that one figure can be many things simultaneously. And I do think that's how dreams work. We accept the logic. There is a sort of logic driven by the subconscious, driven by some kind of understandings that the subconscious is trying to make for us in our waking lives.
And there's that doubleness, isn't there, going on as well? And you use the word metaphor. The world of the dead is, a mirror of the world of the living. And of course, the word metaphor means to carry across. And so you've got that very visual manifestation of a metaphor going on there.
Yes.
It's curious, isn't it, that the roles of parent and child are almost reversed in the poem. It's the daughter who talks with great dignity and wisdom about the uselessness of grief. Around the middle of the poem, for instance, you have her say, "Your rage won't bring one jot of joy. There's no escape from suffering, and nothing to be gained by flailing like a fallen deer, crying out in anguish when there's no way on or back." So she's the one who provides the moral guidance and the consolation. And she actually gets quite impatient, doesn't she? She gets quite cross.
She does. Well, parents can be really irritating. They think so slowly, don't they? Yes, and the great thing is that she sounds like a nagging parent. The moments where the father and daughter actually exchange dialogue is where the poem picks up again, after quite a lot of sort of doctrinal monologue, in a sense, from the Pearl Maiden side. And again, that is a little bit like Dante and Beatrice, you know, getting a telling off from across the river from this beautiful woman.
But do we actually know who the Pearl author was? Are there any clues at all, any theories as to his or her identity?
Well, I think the only thing that is certain probably is that the region in which they lived, so the dialect, the local dialect has been identified up in Staffordshire. There's a lot of talk about various markings in the margins of the manuscript, theories about whether or not it was a sort of aristocrat living in that area. But no, it's not known. I think the poem, in a way, speaks completely freely and in isolation of any sense of personality. Obviously, there's no biography pushing at it from behind. And what we hear, in a way, is a voice of a whole era, a time, a location, a belief system on which or out of which arises this very, very singular and individual story and experience and human experience.
We've talked about the father's grief and how he suffers alone in his dull dungeon, if that's the correct pronunciation, or the darkened dungeon of my sorrow, as you rather beautifully have it. But there are great moments of lightness in the poem too, aren't there?
There's humour as well in that encounter between the father and the daughter, where the father just doesn't seem to be able to get what she's so very plainly explaining, and he's misunderstanding. And there's a wonderful passage where he describes the Pearl Maiden almost like a sort of medieval fashion plate, with great affection and attention to detail and vivacity. So that vivacity, even in his narration of the parable of the vineyard, he's a fantastic storyteller, the Pearl Poet. He's a brilliant storyteller.
Yes, and one of my personal favourite moments is when the father stands looking across the river at God's citadel and compares himself rather charmingly with a quail. You were talking about that imagery from the 14th century world, and you've translated that bit as, "Stock still and dazed as a captured quail, I stared amazed at the dazzling sight." Do you have any particularly favourite passages of your own? Or perhaps if we talk about that first, I wonder if you would end by reading an extract for us, both in the original and translation.
Sure. Favourite passages? Well, I know that the section at the beginning, rather the stanza at the beginning of section four, where he has first seen the child in his dream, he's first seen the child cross the river and he recognises her, was an electric moment for me. I mean, that was another occasion where I can honestly say the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I don't think that's ever happened to me in my life before. That was an incredible moment to translate. I remember exactly where I was when I translated it. Partly, it's the language, but partly it's the true connection between our dreaming world and our waking world. So the waking world contains the sorrow of loss, and it contains the preciousness of those weeks, months, maybe even years after someone very close has died, where you are holding on to them. You don't want to forget what they look like. You want to have them in the front of your mind's eye there, and you want to be able to kind of keep that forever. And that's very also, that moment is also very dreamlike. And that seemed to me like the sort of heart of the poem. It's a dream, but it's all utterly real.
So can we end then by hearing you read that section? That would be fantastic, Joan.
Yeah, so this is the moment. He's just seen her and he doesn't dare move. More than me lester, my dread arose. I stood full stiller and dorster not caller. With een open and mouth full close, I stood as hender as hawk in holler. I hoped that ghostly was that purpose. I dread on ender what shoulda befalla, lest home a shepherd that I there shows, ere I at staven here more staller. Then, fiercer than longing, came the fear. I didn't stir or dare to call to her. Wide-eyed and silent as a hawk, in a great hall, I waited there. I knew that what I saw was spirit, and I feared for what might follow, that within my sight she'd disappear before I could come close to her. So smooth, so small, so delicate, this graceful, innocent girl now rose before me in her royal robes, a precious creature set with pearls.
Jane Draycott. And Jane's version of Pearl is available in paperback from Carcanet Oxford Poets, along with her other collections, including The Night Tree and the T.S. Eliot Award shortlisted Over.
That was Jane Draycott in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Jane on her website at www.janedraycott.org.uk. That's Draycott with two T's. In our forthcoming episode number 31, you'll be able to hear Jane reading from the original Pearl and from her translation. And that concludes episode 27, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 28, the poet and sculptor Pascal Petit explores the catharsis she experiences by transforming trauma into art, and our own interviewer Julia Copus considers the impact of serious illness on the life of the creative artist. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.